The 1997 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 231, Reconciliation, by Trevor Salvey.
Well, I'm really delighted to be here and delighted that you would come and hear me. What do I do to stop that? Is that it? Can you hear me now? Okay. I really want to make our experience this morning more conversational than anything, because I think that that's the way we can get most out of it. But what I thought I would do is just kind of do an introduction to the work. And what really has brought me to this moment and entitling this thought, Reconciliation, is an experience I had about 2-3 years ago, long time ago, much longer than it should have been. And I went in to see a designer friend of mine to talk about getting some promotional materials put together. And we talked about business cards and brochures and this and that. And I said, and maybe someday we'll even do a book. And he said, why someday? And I said, well, just someday. And he said, what about now? And I said, no. But anyway, he persuaded me, and now we're about having the book. And this actually is a rough-up of the dust jacket of the book. And, the correct size and everything. Somebody else's book inside the dust jacket, however, unfortunately.
You have to get back of this microphone.
Okay.
This speaker here, and this is the ones that are feeding back directly to the microphone. So I think you can take a center spot.
Maybe I should just stand behind here and not be so silly, huh? I'll do that. Oh, well. That book was an amazing experience for me because I'd never sort of looked at my work as a body like that. I'd never realized quite what I was doing. It just kind of happened, you know, as I went along. And this now, can you all hear me properly? And this book was kind of like a mini revelation as to what my work was all about. I never sat down when I was born and raised in Africa and said, I'm going to be an artist of this kind or that. In fact, my parents were very strongly encouraging me to paint little African villages on ostrich eggs, which I did for a brief spell and made a little money. And they were very popular, much more so than great big naked paintings. So I had no idea what I was doing. I was raised in a country that was like 1930s Europe, you know. I was born 1940, but it was a country that was an old British colonial country that sort of muddled along, very benign. Even our racism was benign compared to South Africa, but it was still racism. And what I began to when I went to art school in England, it was, again, luck had it. I'm very grateful for these little accidents of fate that I should be placed in Brighton in Sussex in a little provincial, well, it wasn't that little, but a provincial art school. And it took a couple of years before modernism really hit me. Well, by then it was too late. And the die was cast. And by then my passion for the human figure had developed. But what to do with it had not quite developed. So I was in England for 2 years, and I have had a very shaky health when I was younger and had to leave and go back to Africa. So my parents sent me on down to South Africa, where I went to art school in Durban, where I really discovered what racism was all about. In fact, my senior professor was arrested and put under house arrest for his anti-apartheid activities. To my shame, my brother was much more active and aggressive, and he was at a university in the same city. I was much too timid for that. I clucked and fussed and performed, but didn't really do anything too active. But my mind was clearing as to where I knew this thing should be. In fact, it cleared several years before. And that, of course, is the beginning. And I want to stop a moment and tell you what this notion is. That when we came to titling this book, which was right at the very end of the book, I suddenly realized this theme of reconciliation was what this was all about. And it struck me very forcibly that, in a sense, life is a process of reconciling, if you like, paradox or opposites. I once did a painting, which I wish I had a reproduction of here, called Reconciliation. I also did a big bronze that's in Atlanta called Reconciliation. And my older daughter, who's my assistant, gets very cross with me because I used several titles, but for the same title for different works makes cataloging difficult. But it struck me that my work had a lot to do with this process of trying to come to grips with reality, especially for a person like me who's a sort of super romantic, who keep stumbling across the reality that, that Hitler, you know, that makes life a little difficult for a romantic. And so when I was young, and when I was very young, I was raised in a country, as I said, was very benign, but it was very, very clear as to what life should be. And very early, I began not to fit. I was very young. I had this very severe illness, for which I later became rather grateful because it took me out of that society. But I very quickly realized I was a sissy, and even had that term thrown at me. I didn't quite know what it meant, but I knew that I was all wet and that a big drip and all that kind of thing. And I didn't quite fit with the rugger players, you know. Well, maybe the combination of the illness and the rugger and the my resistance to the rugger players, art became my natural outlet. I just realized I have some notes here.
Pardon?
Oh, thank you. Just in case, though, I mean, I did write rugby here, and I wrote sissy. Oh, and later I had a motor scooter. And in those days, you know, real men didn't ride motor scooters; they rode motorcycles. And of course, I later got a motorcycle on which I crashed. But anyway, so this conflict thing, you know, is there for all of us. Some of us, perhaps more than others. I mean, I think that women of my generation probably suffered very greatly if they had a powerful a passion outside of the home. That's a huge conflict that they had to resolve. And that's the nature of a lot of life. And I suppose for me, the exhilaration of life is a consciousness of that and a conscious effort to work with that, knowing that you will never actually reach equilibrium or reconciliation, that it's an ongoing process. That painting that I did was based on the Mormon notion that there must needs be opposition in all things. And it's a 4x4 foot painting, and across the top of the painting is this very serene, nude figure. It's one of the most detailed paintings I've ever done, with a sort of this sense of tranquility. And he's floating in space, but under him there's a line that that outlines his contours. I was looking to see if the same thing occurred on that painting, something I did fairly frequently. Remember that line. Beneath him, on one side, there was a bird flying. On the other side is a dead bird. Then there was a stone, and then a fractured stone. And then there was, I think there was a rose and a thorn, which is the thing that I keep going back to all the time. I think the rose is fascinating because it's a wonderful summary of this whole business of the beauty of life and the pain of life. And then falling beneath the rose is a petal, and then a pearl floats in the space underneath. So that's what the picture looks like. Now, it's fairly obvious when I verbalize it. And one of the things I like to say, and when we talk about this painting, I want to suggest to you a process that, if any of you have heard this before, it'll be boring, but of looking at pictures. One of the most typical ways we look at pictures is, oh, I would never hang that in my living room. Certainly most of you probably wouldn't hang that in your living room. But anyway, that's not a good way to look at pictures. It's not a good way to look at people. You know, if you met a person, shook their hand and said, oh, I wouldn't want to have lunch with him or her, it's kind of a shame because you don't know that person. That first impression is so, we can't trust it. It's certainly helpful. It's certainly helpful. But so what this author proposes, we postpone that kind of decision. And what we say is, what am I looking at? And in fact, why don't we just, no, I'll talk about the reconciliation painting. I told you what we were looking at, didn't I? We're looking at a figure with a red line, still life forms floating underneath it. And that's an inventory. And that's the second phase. Chapter 3, what does it mean? What does it mean? It's fairly obvious in that particular piece as to what it might mean. Any meaning is legitimate. And the joy of art is it presents some information, allowing that you then bring the rest of the information to the experience, and it becomes your art as well as the artist's art. I've actually had a person say to me, I was at this big exhibition the Salt Lake Art Center had for me a couple of months ago, and this person had his children there, and I was trying to explain my work to him, and he poo-pooed me, and he said, oh, Trevor, it doesn't mean that. And he immediately went and explained, was much more eloquent and interesting than anything I'd ever dreamed. So The truth of the matter is that is a great truism about artists. The artist is often the least aware of what he's done. That's what a critic's for. That's why we have critics. Of course, most of the time they're not very smart, but I had a great run-in with a critic in Los Angeles, actually, with the Los Angeles Times. And I'll show you the painting on the slide that this woman zeroed in on and completely didn't see it. So then we go to the next chapter, which is formal analysis. And formal analysis is when we say, what did the artist do? Well, he's got a 4x4 foot panel, and he's painted in oil. This is a highly refined, detailed pictures, but there are some very loose passages beneath the objects. He has this interesting linear contour around the figure. That's probably about it in formal analysis. There you're describing, you know, actually, did I say that already about formal analysis? Because formal analysis should precede interpretation. So then comes interpretation, and okay, you guys participate. What is that painting all about? I called it reconciliation, and I described these objects. Any thoughts on it? Anybody want to risk humiliation? Just remember, you can't be humiliated because your interpretation is as legitimate as anybody else's. So anybody want to venture a guess or a thought?
I'm just struggling with the male figure of the top. You described it great. Those things have been reconciled with that figure.
Uh-huh.
Not having seen the painting, but over 80 years.
Yeah.
I can't go beyond that.
So right.
Play games with exactly what the figures are. On one side, they could be like complete things. On the other side, incomplete, broken, or thorns supposed to grow. So it would be the opposite. So you have to reconcile the figures in the sense of love.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Any other thoughts? That's, you know, it's pretty fairly obvious. Then what I see in this painting is that we are confronted with, we're no sooner confronted with beauty. When I sit in my garden, which, by the way, is one of the main reason I moved to California, was to grow a garden that I could have for more than 3 months of the year. And when I sit in my garden, I have this little bench, and my poor children have literally hauled out by the bucket a ton and a half of clay to build these ponds. This, my daughter sitting over here is nodding her head vigorously, the pain and sorrow that they have to suffer for me. But I sit on this little bench, and right to the left is a small pond that comes down from a waterfall, and the fish are there, and then right across from me is a very tiny little pond, and there's one of those Indian grinding things that tilts slightly, water drops from a copper pipe into that water, into that dish, and then flows down to this tiny little pool. And in that are a couple of fish, and I sit there, and then I have bird feeders, you know, I sit there just sort of mesmerized by all this stuff, and then a mosquito comes. See, it's not supposed to be that way. At least that's been my theory all my life, and it's been very difficult then to reconcile those opposites. So that's a matter of that sense of raccoons come and eat the fish. I've lost several. Some of those fish become my friends, and it devastates me. One was a great big fantail thing that was very fancy, and he was consumed. So I figured, well, if they can eat each other, I get to eat them. So, you know. So I'm trying to be vegetarian, but not doing very well. But anyway, finally then, when we come to a painting like that, we then finally say, I like it or I don't like it. The ideal is that we say it in conjunction with why. Because I've seen another artist do this in a different way, which I like better. Or because I find the figure is too idealized, it doesn't have a sense of guts. Or it's too pretty. Or I really like it, and this is why, you know. So that's the way of looking at art. So as we look at these things, I'd like it if you could try to keep that in mind. And what I want to do is have a kind of conversation on the subject of reconciliation, and see if we can come to terms. And I, of course, and most of you, I'm sure, are aware of this, had a massive, very, very painful reconciliation to take care of in my life. But I want to quickly go through some of the others. Racism. When I was about 16, my little country was struggling with race, and we had some very enlightened leaders at that time, and they began to break down racial barriers so that on the trains, which had been segregated, there was no more segregation. If a black person wanted to buy a first-class, second-class, third-class ticket, they had the right, and the white people had the same right. And the voting system changed so that Africans could participate. We called the black people Africans, and we were called Europeans, which is hysterical because of the fact that my family go back 300 years in Africa. I was more African than European, just as you were more American than European. But nevertheless, those are the terms we used. And they broke the voters' roll down so that there was this a double roll, an A roll for those who were super-duper qualified and a B roll for the peasants like me who dropped out of high school. And, of course, naturally, most of the Africans who could, and then, of course, many people couldn't qualify at all because there were minimal qualifications on the B roll for which I qualified. And so there was this attempt to break down. And I remember sitting at a dinner table with my parents, and my father was saying, and I was saying how enthusiastic I was about these changes. And my father said, how could you feel comfortable with your mother sitting in the same compartment on a train with an African? And I said, Dad, these people come into our homes, wash our clothes, cook our food, tend our babies, make our beds, clean our houses, service our food, and that too unclean to sit next to us in a compartment. So that's one of the first things I had to come to terms with. And later that comes back to haunt me, not too much later. But racism is the most absurd thing, to my way of thinking, that has ever existed. And now that, of course, I live in America where in fairness, I have to say that 90% of the Africans, certainly maybe even 100% of the Africans that my parents knew or that I knew, and we have pictures of them coming up in the slides, were essentially tribesmen. I remember William, my mother's gardener, trying to explain to him what the ocean was. He couldn't conceive it. And, of course, most of us here cannot imagine such a simple view of the world. But they really were very simple people. And so the whites theorized that you can't just give the vote willy-nilly to these people because they have no sense of what to do with it. And since they are so childlike, they will then be subject to intimidation, which, indeed, when the war started, they were. And just as the same in Vietnam, where if you didn't do what the North Vietnamese wanted you to do, you suffered the consequences. Same thing happened. And so the whites were, trying to cope with all that stuff. But that still doesn't excuse the fundamental belief system. But it was changing, and that's what's so tragic. It didn't change. There was then a reaction against the changes, and that led to what is now Rhodesia, was then Rhodesia being Zimbabwe now. So those are the kinds of things. I had to come to terms with a culture that said these people were inferior. These people, not only were they inferior, they would never have the capacity to be as wonderful as we were. Ian Smith said, not in 500 years would they qualify. I can't believe anybody with a modicum of intelligence saying a thing like that. Ian Smith was a prime minister, by the way, at the later stages. Yes. Oh, I'm so glad you're interrupting.
History is a process of
reconciliation. It is. Right. Right. That's true. And what's just happened in Hong Kong is a reconciliation. The thing that's interesting about this word, though, is how people it pops up. A friend of mine who's in England, when I sent her information about the book, and she wrote back and said, "Are you going back to the Mormon Church?" Because she sees it in such a much more global view. What I'm talking about is just these little things on the day-to-day existence, and it begins to hit us more and more and more, in just day-to-day life, if we start to stop to think about it. When I got to England to go to art school, I was confronted there with all these guys that were trundling down to the pub every night and getting drunk, and my whole psyche rebelled against that. And I just didn't quite know what to do, and I never quite fitted in. And there's a very natural consequence to all this. By the way, I was not raised LDS. And when I was in school, backtracking a little bit, I again suffered the consequences of that same kind of isolation. I simply never quite fitted. I remember one day, this was after I'd been in bed for a couple of years with this illness, the teacher had the temerity to suggest I should have done my homework better. And I slammed the book down and ran out and ran home. Well, I had rheumatic fever with a weak heart. The whole school panicked, thinking I was going to die. But you see, I just couldn't. I had then become cocooned, in a sense, within that illness, so that I simply couldn't deal with this reality that the teacher had said very firmly, you should have done your homework better. And so, there was this big to-do because they sent a bunch of rugby players to chase me and catch me, and so that I wouldn't die. And all they wanted to do was to tell me not to run but to walk. But, of course, I thought they were trying to catch me to drag me back. So it was a great make movie, huh?
What age were you then?
Oh, I was very young then. I was probably 9 or 10, I'd imagine. So I had to backtrack a little bit there. Well, finally, I go to South Africa from England, and there I feel more comfortable. There I'm dealing with really mean-spirited racism. I mean, it was, when you cross the border from from Rhodesia to South Africa, in those days, in my view, there was a palpable sense of the police state. All of a sudden, the signs, I don't remember signs ever that said whites only in Rhodesia. I'm sure they probably were there, but I don't remember them. In South Africa, they were everywhere. And it was nie blankies, which is Afrikaans for whites. Whites only. I mean, even to the point of just summarizing all other races into one big lump, which later, by the way, when it became convenient, they changed because they liked to do business with the Japanese, but they were mad at the Chinese. So Japanese were honorable, honorary whites, but the Chinese were not. And of course, and you had to categorize. Yes. African. The Chinese were lumped with the Africans, and then they also had what they called colored, which were mixed race. And by the way, we're coming to a little moment of truth here with this mixed race business. I'll remind me to tell you about it. And then they had Indians, East Indians, that they imported way back for labor. And needless to say, some funny little things happened, like the word for a banana in Afrikaans is pisang, which is a Malay word. So it's an Eastern word that they had adapted into their language. So it was very funny in a way. But it was cruel. It was very cruel. And as I said, my teacher disappeared. And later I discovered he'd been put under house arrest. Because if you were liberal and voiced your opinion too loudly, that's what happened to you. So anyway, while I was there, one day, and many of you have heard the story, but if you haven't, my brother and I had a habit of going to the city hall on Sunday evenings for a free symphony concert. It had to be free because we were so cheap. But anyway, we went one night, and then they had intermission came, and they said, oh, we have a little special thing happening. And these four young men stepped out onto the stage and started to sing in a cappella beautifully. And so we were mesmerized, and they were Mormon missionaries singing little things about mosquitoes and picnics, I remember, and come, come, ye Satan, saints, and things like that. And I was so compelled by them. I should point out, however, I was already compelled to America, thanks to Doris Day and Rock Hudson movies. Doris Day and Rock Hudson, by the way, told me what life was all about. Life was all about a Hollywood movie, you know. And so that was a double reason to want to meet these people, who then offered their services afterwards to do so. And this is one of these strange little twists of fate. And these are fascinating to me, the way these things happen. When my brother wasn't interested, he was much more intellectual than I. But when I wanted to meet them, there was a huge throng around them. So he said, "Let's go." So finally, we took off, and he took off. He was a rugby player, and we shared the scooter. He had the scooter. I was walking that week, and I was walking back to my residential hotel, and came abreast of a man that I'd seen in the dining room, and we'd nodded to each other. We'd never said a word, you know. And his last name was Dollar, I remember. And we started to chat, and it evolved. He'd been to the concert. I was kind of surprised because he was a very earthy bloke, and I wouldn't expect him to be at a concert. But it evolved that he asked me what I liked best in the concert. I said, "Well, frankly, I like those guys singing in the middle best of all." And he said, "Really?" I said, "I thought they were fantastic. I'd love to have met them." Now, Durban is a large city, and the Mormon church, there was one Mormon church, and probably active attendance were 70 people, I would say, at that point. He turns out to be Mormon, and he says to me, "If you really would like to meet them, come to church with me on Sunday." Of course, immediately backed off then, you know. But he persuaded me to go to the MIA, and of course, that was a major turning point for me. And I met the missionaries, and the first thing I asked them was, "What is your church's position on black people?" And they very, very astutely said, "We'll tell you later." So by the time I was hooked, they told me, and then there was a major, major reconciliation for me there. Because I was now so entranced by this vision of a group of people. And I'd always been utopian in nature. I mean, the rough and tough world was hard on me. So I dreamed of this wonderful place that you could go to be among people who were gentle folk. And so they got me hooked. And in fact, I think, I don't know, it doesn't matter. But then finally they told me, I was absolutely devastated. And I remember talking to a Methodist friend of mine, and he said, "You see? You know, these Mormons are bizarre people, da 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 da." But, I mean, here was God telling me that apartheid was right. Talk about a reconciliation. Well, I never was able to reconcile it. The only thing I could do was shelve it, which I started to do along with several other things about the church at the same time. I just shelved these things. I said, in fact, I was told, "Don't worry about it. Eventually, you'll understand it." I never did. So, however, with that conversion, I finished art school and then went on a mission and then came to Zion. And what was Zion? Zion was that wonderful place in the mountains where the desert had blossomed as a rose. My mission was in South Africa, so I got more of apartheid. And I remember being told, you must not, if Africans even approach you, you do not teach them, you know. So it was very tough. But anyway, I didn't want this to turn into kind of biographical treatise, and I'm a little embarrassed. So you guys interrupt more. But what I'm trying to do is explain this whole business of these opposites and how difficult they are to deal with. And we're going to come to the great climax, and then I'll shut up and we can have a conversation. But Zion, this wonderful dreamlike place, I arrived in an evening. I remember it was a great odyssey for me. I went by ship to England, 2 weeks, seasick much of the time, and then from England by ship again. And I remember I'm a late riser, but that morning I got up at 5 o'clock so that as we approached New York, it was dawn, and the towers of the cities rose out of the water. I mean, it really, you can understand how those immigrants must have felt. What an experience. Then, of course, I was so exhausted, I went downstairs and took a nap, and I woke up, and the ship was empty, and I got up just in time. The immigration people were just leaving, so I would have been stranded. But anyway, then, of course, I dealt with trying to find the heat, absolute July, unmitigated hell. And I had never known such heat. I mean, coming from Africa, I'd never known heat like that. So anyway, then from there, I had some wonderful times with the church there, and then went down, saw some sites, Washington, D.C., and then met a person who, when we drove across the country. And arriving in Zion was a similar experience as arriving in New York. Sunset, coming down, the sun glinting off the lake, magic, you know, this was Zion. This was a huge pilgrimage for me. I was ecstatic. You can well imagine. I was then 25 years old. The next morning, I discovered State Street, and I realized Zion had a long way to go, and smog, and all of the things that just shattered me. If you can imagine, I mean, Main Street had no trees growing on it in those days. I mean, as I said, capitalism was king, not the Lord, and it really was hard on me. So BYU was a little bit of a salvation, because at least it was clean, clinical and clean, not particularly inspired, but at least it was so, and I went to BYU. So anyway, I'm going to sort of cut this long story short now and just kind of race to the quick here. Of course, going to BYU, I'd internalized the idea that absolutely the pinnacle of life, and to this day I feel that the pinnacle of life, and it's an enormous, it is a challenge that I believe is rarely met in the way that is ideal, and that's companionship. So I was at BYU for two reasons, to get an education and also to find a wife. And at this exhibition, one of the women I dated, who was the Relief Society president, I'd not seen her for 30 years. She'd signed and said, oh, let's you know, she and her husband had come to the show and so on. So I went through this process, but I was wretched at it, you know. It was really bad. And finally, I dated a wonderful lady for a brief while. Well, actually, it wasn't that brief, and I remember it was getting very serious, but we never touched each other. And then one day I kissed her, and she was very upset. So I never kissed her again. And indeed, I backed off. And I had the impression that I had, you know, that was saved for marriage, you know. And I didn't know very much about this stuff. I mean, Doris Day and Rock Hudson notwithstanding. So finally, this woman had a friend who is my daughter's mother. And the woman was so, for some, I don't know whether I contributed to this, but she went off on a mission to Switzerland. And Elaine, my wife, became a very close friend. The friend would send her her journal, and Elaine faithfully typed the journal for her. And one day, I'd only met her once, we bumped into each other in the Wilkinson Center, and the Student Union building, and we started talking about the friend in Switzerland. That's all we talked about. But we both had to go places. I said, well, let's get together Friday and talk this through, because I was very, I hate hurting people. It's devastating to me. Life itself is cruel enough without us inflicting we inflicting, whatever, pain on each other. So we got together and never mentioned the friend once. We just kind of, ding, you know, we met. 2.5 weeks later, we were engaged, and 2 months later, we were married. And it was, she's a remarkable woman. absolutely remarkable. And we connected at a potent level. All of our dreams and visions just seemed to coincide. It was totally synchronized. However, I was in a deep panic because she, unlike her friend, wanted to hold my hand. But I found myself feeling terribly suffocated by that. And all along, I'd been confronting the greatest difficulty to reconcile in my life, which was my sexuality. There was a very natural reason that holding my wife's hand was uncomfortable for me. It was like incest to me. It was unnatural. I didn't realize that at the time, but you just overcome it. I had gone to counseling at the university. In fact, I'd come to this up here and met Spencer W. Kimball, who had given me a very strange experience on the subject. And I was determined that this was going to be put to sleep. This was not Rock Hudson and Doris Day. Little did I know about Rock Hudson later, but this just didn't fit the program. I mean, here was the blueprint. You follow it or else. You're going to be miserable. And that's what Spencer told me, in fact. In fact, he said I'd be miserable in no uncertain terms, because if I didn't follow it, I'd be out of the university and out of the country, you know. So anyway, I'm grateful for one thing in my life, is that I told her. Three times in our courtship, I broke down hysterical, crying, just absolutely terrified of what was happening. And to this day, we were both highly irresponsible, because we should never have married so quickly, at least. But we did, and everybody had told us, well, you know, it's wonderful at this stage, and then the tough times come. And we kept saying to each other, where are the tough times? Well, of course, the tough times were there, but neither of us, we were both in a kind of denial, I guess. So anyway, dreamers that we were. In the meantime, I had met Dennis Smith and Gary Smith, of whom some of you may have met, artists, and we formed a group who were determined. Oh, I forgot to tell you all about another reconciliation. Stopping in New York City, I went to the World's Fair, and I, of course, was going to the LDS Pavilion, and I was so excited about it. But before I went there, I went to those peasants, the Catholics, and they had imported Michelangelo. They'd never do today, but they had shipped Michelangelo's Pietà for that World's Fair. And I went there, and Michelangelo, there are two or three artists in his history who are very obvious influences on me, and he was one of them. And so I was absolutely, you know, enraptured. Then I went over to the LDS Pavilion, and the art there, sagging spirits. I mean, I said, oh, but then my spirits came up, and I said, aha, this is why the Lord wanted me to come here. I'm supposed to be the LDS Church's Michelangelo. See? So right after I arrived, I went to visit I contacted the church here and said, you know, I want to do some work for you. And so they put me in touch with a company called Evans Advertising, which I thought was a little odd. And I went to Evans Advertising, and they gave me information. They said, we want you to paint Joseph Smith's first vision. And so I painted the Joseph Smith first vision as I perceived it to be. I mean, this is frontier country, right? So Joseph was barefooted, and his clothes were kind of farm boyish. I mean, he was a boy. And I had him in the grove, and I was terribly pleased with myself and took it back. And I went back a little while later, and they said, you know, we want you to do it, work over it again. We want him in a suit with buttons, and you need to know how many button suits had on those days. What were his shoes like? I said, but you know, this is a country boy. This is frontier. Is he going to put his best Sunday shoes on to go walking in the woods? I find this highly unlikely, you know. Do it! Well, what I discovered was that all those paintings in the pavilion had been done by a Seventh-day Adventist. Very good reason. The Seventh-day Adventist didn't have any sense of what Joseph Smith was. He didn't care about Joseph Smith. He just painted what they told him to do. So that was the beginning of a great problem for me. How to reconcile it? Do your own thing, and then show them that you're right and they're wrong, because needless to say, I didn't succeed in that. But Gary, Dennis, and a few other folks and I, we got together, we started talking about this stuff, and we literally dreamed of a renaissance in art that would not only be a renaissance within the LDS Church, but within the art world, because I'd stopped at the Museum of Modern Art, and I'd say, what are these people doing? You know, but I have to confess, I was very compelled, and you can see in my work, influences, the language of modernism is there. I mean, Michelangelo would never have done that or that with these strong geometric fragments that come because of modernism. So I'm very grateful to modernism, but it was inhumane to a large extent for me. It didn't speak to my soul. So there were two reasons here. So I came and I started, we got going with the Mormon group called, we called it Art and Belief. We had an exhibition in the library, which we transferred up to the BYU Student Union building, caused a great excitement, and out of it grew what is to this day the Mormon Festival of Arts at BYU. So that was our method of, and it was a wonderful experience. But we were terrified too, because we were all very devout, but we kept attracting these rebellious people, like you Sunstone people, you know, and it made us very nervous. But it became a very powerful force, and it was enormously good for us. Dennis bullied me to move to Alpine with Elaine, which we did, and then gradually this whole group began to gather in Alpine. So Zion may have failed, but we were going to create our own utopia. And so we were this wild dreaming bunch, you know. And we got together and had these meetings, and we'd have these huge arguments, and then we'd have these seminars at the weekend. I remember one seminar we had on our place. My poor wife, I bullied her. I told her we had to have a cow because, you know, utopia had to have a cow, which we shared with Marvin Payne. Well, I had arthritis in my hand, so I guess we ended up milking the cow. But she was raised on a dairy farm. I'd have to muck out the barn. I was the one that did the manure part, you know. But I remember we had the seminar, and we were all in my garden. It was so idyllic, you know, this little brook. They called it a ditch. I called it a brook running by, you know. And we were sitting there drawing, and there was Moo the cow out in the pasture. And then all of a sudden we realized she was giving birth, so we witnessed this wonderful experience of Moo giving birth. You know, people from – we didn't have a huge crowd. We'd have 10 or 12 people come. It was a great, great time. But needless to say, throughout that great, great time, that black thing was there. But more difficult was that I was dying inside because I couldn't give the love to Elaine that she deserved, and she couldn't give that. She wanted to give me the love, but I couldn't receive it. In the meantime, we had these four incredible children. Well, if there's a spider in the house, I try to cohabit. You know, I don't want to hurt the spider. They bite me. So eventually we have a war and they lose. But nonetheless, I try hard, you know, for the lamb and the lion lying down together. Well, this person who doesn't want to hurt a spider has these four children. I'm a passionate father. I just love being a father. And I love my children to this day. And they'll tell you. And I have friends who think I'm neurotic in my relationship to my children. But we are extremely, extremely close. Here I was suddenly put into the place where I knew that I was psychologically dying. Talk about reconciliation. How do I reconcile the fact that I was dying, spiritually dying, and the only way that I could save myself, that I could see, was to leave my wife, whom we loved each other dearly, and she knew a lot of what was going on, was to leave her and my children. It was unmitigated hell. It took us 5 years to do it, and it was devastating. Devastating, devastating experience. And to this day, it's not. Given the church and plans to be married in the temple, she grieves with the fact, I won't be there to witness her wedding. Talk about reconciliation. It's a tough business. Finally, I did leave, and Elaine and I had a very difficult time the first year because she was so desperately hurt. But then we became extremely close friends for 5 years until she remarried, and then she's got on with her life. And so all of that's a detail that we don't necessarily have to go into now. So what I want to do is I want to quickly have you see these slides. Stop me if you want me to talk about a particular image. They, in effect, illustrate what I've told you. And then we'll have since you're so bad at conversing, then we'll have the conversation. So does somebody... Do we have a high... Yes.
I have a question. Yeah. At what point did you become actively gay? Was that during... And I'm assuming that...
Well, no, right about the time of my divorce. And even then, I wasn't.
5 years.
Yeah, I was not. I mean, I had had. I didn't tell you this amazing thing that happened. I talked about. It was a little bit like running into that young man in Durban who took me to church. I moved into when I became engaged. I was in an apartment with four other guys, all five of us again. By accident of fate, none of us knew each other before. David Kest's parents, mother, had said, "Find some roommates. You can stay downstairs, and we need to get some renters here." And he was in my ward. He said, "Trevor, you want a place to stay?" And I liked him, so sure. So five of us ended up there, all five of us there. All four of those guys, not one of them married, they all looked at me like I was a Looney Tune, and I looked at them as if they were Looney Tunes. But when I finally began to have to come to terms with this, I contacted David, and that in turn led to a network. And Elaine tried so hard. She actually went to parties with me, met a lot of people. I'd never forget, you know, she'd get this young return missionary and she'd nail him to the wall, so to speak, and say, "Well, how the heck do you end up here?" kind of. She wouldn't put it in those terms, but Elaine's into psychology. That's her business. So she wants to understand. So she tried so hard. So in a sense, it was a kind of gradual transition at that phase, and then probably a year, 18 months later, we finally separated. so.
Trevor?
Yeah.
I heard you were quite exotic back then. You would wear African robes.
Oh, I did not. I wasn't at all exotic. I'll come back to the mic in case you... Do you want me to address the issue of being exotic?
No African robes.
No, actually, there weren't African robes. I started to gain weight, and I found clothing very uncomfortable, so I bullied Elaine, and she made me this robe, which to this day I have and treasure, based on a shirt design, and my daughter's over there hooting and laughing. But she chose a royal blue, and then I insisted that I had red racing stripes on it. And so when we had our art and belief groups around and parties and things, I would be in my robe, and I loved it, and because I didn't have to have a belt around my waist. So that's as exotic as I was. No, I mean, I was in the sense that the situation was there, and Elaine was raised down in southern Utah, so but if I suggested something, she'd usually go along with it. She eventually said, I'm not going to dig any more holes for roses, you know. Interesting. That's an interesting notion, but I mean, what it amounted to is I had these crazy ideas. She loved them, and so she bought into them. And basically, she just did everything I wanted until she started getting rebellious and refused to dig rose plant holes. By the way, we eventually summarized our relationship this way. One Christmas, we suddenly realized that she was out chopping firewood and I was decorating gingerbread man. So we had it down. I mean, we had a grand time in many ways, but it was still very, very painful, especially that latter part. So, no, I don't know if I would call myself... To me, a patriarchal person says, this is the way it is. I am the patriarch in this house. You do it this way. And I don't recollect... that's not my nature. Is that my nature, Susanna? In fact, my son says, Dad, you're a wuss, you know. I mean, in fact, just a few days ago, I had this experience. I had this person who had been very unkind to me. So I left a message for him on my phone because he was going to take care of my ancient mother. And I thought the next day, and I thought I had been very firm and very strong, you know. So I said, you know, I was very cold, I thought, da 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 da. The next day, I have called in to call, pick up my messages and listen to my message. I sounded almost like Mr. Sweetness and Light. I couldn't believe it. And I told my son this. He said, Dad, you know, when we were teenagers and we wouldn't do the dishes and you try to get sticked, it was just a hoot. Nobody took me seriously. So I don't think I did very well as a patriarch. Susanna, do you think I was patriarchal? No. I'm a wuss, so wusses can't be patriarchal. So, okay, any other questions before we quickly look at these slides?
Can we plunge the face in darkness? Guy, did you run the slide for me?
Or is there another more technical person? Oh, goodness. He doesn't know how to do it any better than I do. The first slides introduce you to a couple of Africans who are very familiar to us. If Guy can ever get it to work. I think this first one is the monkey nut man. Monkey nuts, by the way, were what we call peanuts. And he would come around to the house and go all over Sulukwe, the town we were, a little village chrome mining town that we were in, selling monkey nuts. And we all were always speculating as to how ancient he was, and he had no idea himself. But we figured he was, judging by what he told us, he witnessed when he was young, we couldn't communicate very well because he couldn't speak English, we couldn't speak his language. And there was a multitude of languages, but we spoke a kind of pidgin African. Okay, Guy, thanks. And this gentleman here is Johnny Chapinga, who was my mother's cook and chief bottle washer. And he was with us for 20 years. He was from the Makaranga tribe. And we were very, very, had a great relationship. He was a dreadful worker. My mother was always railing at him, and he was always giggling at her hysterics.
What's your age during this
painting? I was, well, actually, he was probably hired when I was a teenager. And so he was there until my parents left to come to the U.S. in 76. He was with them.
So you're painting this before in your teens?
Actually, this piece, when I went back to Africa, I did both of these pieces. I went back. When I went back, I did them. So they were done probably in 70. And here's a couple of details, and this is just fun. Go to the next one, guys. It's just kind of fun to blow up and get closer. And I don't know if you want a quick art lesson, but one of the things about art, very frequently we're terribly impressed because a person can make something look like something. But that's only part of it. The other thing is to have that the lines have a life and the vitality of their own, because otherwise you might just want to take a photograph. That's why, you know, a portraiture is a legitimate art form, because it transcends a photograph. Okay, Guy. This is the one of the, this was probably the first major painting I did when I came to the States. It's 6 feet wide and 8 feet tall, and the title is The Plan, and it's a very bad style. BYU owned it. They bought it for $300. It would probably be $30,000 today. And it starts out here in the pre-existence with these spirits reaching down. Can you focus that any better, Guy, or is that as good as it gets? It is as good as it gets. And here's a newborn infant, this little family environment, and these are themes I can't quite get away from. And that here's a man bound by thorns. Here's another man bound by barbed wire. That's the mosquitoes biting and Hitler and all that stuff. And then finally, so we have these experiences, you know, the nurturing positive and then the damage and the brutality. That person was very unkind to me last week. He had a father that literally has destroyed this young man's capacity to socialize. He doesn't know how to be with another human being at an intimate level without bullying them. It's really amazing. So that represents this. And then finally, death and the resurrection with a hint of the second coming.
Do they ever?
This one, I wanted it for my exhibition at the Art Center. By the way, how many of you did see that show? Oh, quite a few. Good. It was an incredible experience for me to have that work all gathered together. But they say it's damaged and it's very fragile, so at this point they're not exhibiting it. They've got a fairly important, but probably the most important collection. The University of Utah, the State Museum have a pretty good one too. But okay, Guy, thanks. And this piece is, of course, obviously entitled Ordination. And I loved all this stuff. I loved the sense of belonging and sense of... I mean, I think it's such a wonderful thing to bring children... I think that... I wish the government would study the Mormon Church and to say, this is how we're going to run the country. We're going to break every city and town down into wards and stakes and do it this way. It's an absolute work of genius. Go ahead. And then this is entitled, And He Shall Be Red in His Apparel. And as the one supplicant representing all meets Jesus. Okay, Guy? And this is the damned, where supplicants, in my view, remember I said there's no greater achievement than in effect, marriage. This is where, finally, you're denied the greatest achievement, which is access to another human being at that level. Guy?
When did you start painting with Carolyn?
Right about the time I did that painting, very soon after I arrived. In fact, Gerald and Carolyn were involved in the Art and Belief group, and Carolyn not very actively, but Gerald more actively. But Gerald Pearson, by the way, was Carolyn's husband, for those of you who don't know that. But she, so that would have been 66, 67, okay. This is entitled Crucifixion, obviously. And this piece, go to the next one, is actually underneath this piece. You can barely see it. But this is the resurrected Christ moving away from the body. It really wasn't a particularly successful piece because you could barely see the crucifixion bit underneath it. This is going to be in the book nonetheless. But most of these pieces are going to be in the book. And by the way, for those of you who are interested, we have a laser printout of the book here, which we'll hand about. Well, I might just hand it out as loose afterwards while we're having our conversation. And what time are we supposed to quit? At 12:30? 12:45. Okay. Next guy. And here's another piece. Now, by the way, this is what I'm doing here is engraving on plexiglass, just scratching it. And it was an accidental discovery that gave me great pleasure. Actually, it wasn't. I think my friend Marilyn Miller had done it and showed me how to do it. But this piece also has figures underneath. And this piece, the figures, this is a detail. There's a figure on the right and a figure on the left separated. And you see, if you think about it, a lot of this shows the great yearning that I was going through, and they come together. Of course, I didn't have the courage to do male on male. This was, and of course, it's just as legitimate, obviously, you know. So, I mean, it still expresses my feeling. Thanks, Guy. This piece is one of my great favorites, we don't know. Is anybody knows where this painting is? Scream, holler, and jump up and down, because I'd love to get a good picture of it. But it represents birth and the idea of the spirit in the pre-existence, anticipating. To me, it's a fascinating notion. Here's this great liberated spirit anticipating coming to life, and you fold yourself down into this tiny little body, just helpless and blood-ridden and contained within your mother. And you know, we love to romanticize. And, of course, this embryonic figure is one that means an enormous amount to me. I don't know why it is. Maybe it's as if I believe that each of us is sleeping in that way, and that's the embryo of a God notion. And then so we fold ourselves down into that. And you think about, we love to romanticize and think about as a mother, you know, within the LDS faith, it's often the truth, where a child is born into that environment. But most children are born into horrific environments. Carry on. An expression of the same. As I said, I love being a dad, and I remember when my babies were this big, and I loved that whole experience so passionately, and still do. Okay. And then, for me, as you can tell, I tend to deal with idealized and romanticized environments rather than realistic. But this wonderful lady was sitting in church. Her name was Olive Patterson, and I was so compelled by her beauty, the way the light fell on it, that I decided. So she's in the same framework as Johnny Chapinga and the Monkey Nut Man. So I touch into reality often, particularly with commissioned portraits too.
Are they still etching?
This is an etching. Those other two, by the way, were drawings, but I think we actually have etchings of, not the Monkey Nut Man, but of Johnny Chapinga. Maybe we have one here. Oh, there's one. Isn't that in the auction guy?
Yes, Johnny.
Johnny Chapinga's in the auction, so. Okay. And this is a detail of a painting, a painting that is a great notion, but it was a disaster, except for the eye. I like the eye. And in it, it was a woman, and I always insisted, you know, the lamb and the lion business. In our brook, we were going to have ducks. Come hell or high water, we were going to have ducks. So I tried the ducklings, and they were washed downstream by the mountain floods one year. The next year, dogs ate them. And finally, I got two geese, and the ducks thrived because the geese chased the dogs away most of the time. But one day, a dog caught one of these ducks, and I came running out, and the duck was very badly, badly mauled on the back. And I took it into the brook and dropped it down to bathe it, and hopefully the cool would help it, you know. And it just sort of died in my hands. And at that moment, it was such a kind of devastation, you know, that in mortality, we're not going to know that kind of tranquility. I still haven't given up. And so I did this painting of this woman with that duck, and as kind of a the painting itself is not very big. I don't even know where it is either. It's probably about that big, I think. So this is a oil paint. This is a vastly enlarged eye. Okay, guy. This painting is also on the same topic. It's called Earth Union. Of course, this is not supposed to be there. If I was organized, you wouldn't see that. And one of the things that I gradually began to realize is that Rock Hudson and Doris Day would not be together in eternity if they didn't come to terms with the planet. That our union, our marriage, is much bigger than ourselves. Of course, it naturally includes our children, but the responsibility to the entire environment, that sense of reconciling, pulling together, coming to terms with the opposition, and have that sense of stewardship and responsibility, shows in this piece here. And in this piece, the figure on the left, you see how fractured she is, separated from the figure on the right, because they don't comprehend this. They do not meet each other at that level. And I do believe that kind of union is ideally achieved as we meet each other at every single possible level. The more levels we meet at, the greater our union, and the greater, by the way, our individual reconciliation. And then the central figures are in this great communion of power as they take the three symbols of the earth, the apple, the bird, and the stone, and they cradle them and say, yes, we accept this. Thanks, guy. These are a couple of details up.
Go
to the detailed one, the next one, guy. No, you're going backwards. This woman here?
Yes. Well, her hand is...
Her hand's fractured? Oh yeah, her hands are fractured, and that was okay. Now that wasn't something I set out to do. I didn't like the way it was working out, and so I started to take it away. And then I thought, no, I don't want to take it away. So I wiped it back and thought, well, a little fragment existed. And then I realized, and this is very much the way I work. I realized that what was happening was I wanted there. It was expressing what I was feeling, so I kept it there.
You always use models in your paintings?
No, I don't always use malt. I have done them many, many times, of course, but I find more and more I'm working from memory, and I just go. I have a huge morgue, as I call it, a library of photographs that I can go to. And then if I get into trouble, I'll call in a model. Thanks, Guy. The apples, the symbols here are symbols of the earth.
Is that a rock?
That's a rock, and a bird, and an apple. Okay. It's nice to get up close and examine a painting in this way. By the way, that's part of that process. Even though you may not hang it in your living room, if you have that kind of intense involvement, you've been at least touched by it. Thanks, Guy.
Is this oil?
That's oil. Oil on panel. However, that, in a sense, summarizes where I was in Alpine in Utah. This summarizes where I was in San Francisco 5 years later, and where I was still struggling with the terrible pain I'd inflicted on my family, and I was still struggling with my own sense of isolation. For 15 years, I was isolated. I didn't have anybody in my life except some extremely close friends. I kept going to an unrequited situations. And this piece I call Press, and it's very much very representative, I think, of that sense of confinement and struggle that depression represents. Thanks, Guy. This one I called Haven. Actually, it's a painting that was done in Alpine itself, and it was done as a triptych. This is the right-hand panel. We'll show the central panel next. And it represents the man rejected who chose not to choose Jesus. And he is like the damned figure. He is isolated. But I later saw it as a man seeking haven, and so I changed the title to Haven and separated the three panels. Thanks, Guy. Oh, this is Disco Jesus. and actually, it's a terrible painting, but that I gradually changed. And this was the one I told you the L.A. Times critic was so rude about. But actually, when she saw it, the hair had gone, and he was bald, and his eyes were no longer Beach Boy Bimbo Blue. She described this painting as if you read the critique, you'd think she was saying that I was proselytizing religion. Well, at that time, I'd left the church, I was excommunicated, I'd now reached a point of at least agnosticism. I was doing anything but. This painting was then called God Gains. And written on the painting were various terms about God that I considered to be very damaging to human beings. At this point, I'd reached a stage where I was very aware of what Islam does to people when it whispers in a baby's ear at birth, Allah is God and Muhammad is his prophet. That kind of programming, which we too in our LDS culture, Catholic culture, whatever, we do to each other all the time, to my way of thinking, that's the kind of religion that does more harm than good. And the results are some terribly, terribly damaged people. So that's what that painting was all about by the time I got done with the next guy. However, even that press drawing that represented that terrible sense of isolation, I still had the sense of elation because I was coming to terms with myself. And so this sculpture represents that. Next guy. And this painting, which I call Pain Integration, also represents that. And by the way, I told you what a wuss I was. I think that what I do is put all my strength into my paintings. Because there are two words that are used about my work more frequently than others. Strength and spiritual. Strong and spiritual. And it's so interesting that I'm at best agnostic and I'm a wuss, and yet those are the two words. So I think that's interesting. That's where it all ends up, I suppose. And I think this is the last slide. And here we are back to the bird. Again, is the focus no better than that, huh? The rose, the bird, and the stone. And here is an etching that I used. Artists are supposed to cancel their plates. The way I cancel them is screw them to a panel and make them part of a painting. And this was called Softening, and it represented at that time the breaking heart of a man who realizes the wages of sin. This is the same man who is reconciled. And I represent the reconciliation because he is in focus with the planet. Even though he's still isolated, he's in focus with the planet. I think that's the end. Press and let's see if that's the end, Guy. I think it is. It doesn't matter. Okay.
I'm done. Part of reconciliation is letting go.
Yes.
I want to know what your personal experience clinging, if you do, to paintings that you make, which you know are eventually going to become the property of somebody else and hang wherever you don't even know.
It's easy to let go when starvation is imminent.
The sense of commerce is more powerful than
I said it earlier. Commerce is king. You know, no. The bottom line is it actually is quite difficult. I tell you what, it's more difficult for me is when I had that huge exhibition and seeing these old friends that were gone, and in some cases not appreciated, though most were. Even though there are several people who were selling their pieces for vastly increased sums of money, it isn't as painful because there's more where they came from. But in my home, I have my parents' portraits, a self-portrait, and etchings, and that's it. But my children are buying back one of these paintings for the home. So the reconciliation one, as a matter of fact. So we're going to keep that. Now I'm to the point that I actually can start beginning to think about keeping work. Yes?
We have one of your pieces hanging in our room. And it's the two roses, the white rose, the red rose. It has very, very, very fine script on it that has been written by your hand.
That's illegible, right?
That is almost illegible, and you work very hard to force us, therefore, that's it. Exactly. You force us to get in close, like you were speaking a moment ago. Were there other reasons?
I love to have writing on the work, but this is a visual statement. And so one of the reasons I tend to, and I also don't think of myself as being much of a writer, so I'm a little uncomfortable about appearing to be a writer. This book has absolutely horrified me because I had to appear to be a writer. Carolyn was wonderful. She was one of the editors, and she said to me, Trevor, give up. You're not a writer. She said, don't pretend that there's such a thing as a comma or a complete sentence or chronology. Just give up. Just let it flow the way you converse, and you'll see the form the book has taken, we have a primary author, but the form the book has taken is kind of like a free-flowing, I don't know what you call it, it's not poetry, not prose, it's Trevorisms. So that's why, that's one of the reasons, so there's two reasons of why I tend. If I feel it particularly strong, I mean, for example, on the cover of the book, and I'm so thrilled with this piece, the design, the cover is wonderfully designed, I think, but it doesn't... You wouldn't think Trevor Savage saw that, would you? And so I was a little uncomfortable with that, but I kind of decided I like the element of surprise when you get inside. But there are two words here, remembered light, which are very carefully painted, because I felt good about them.
So, could you explain some of your work around the room?
Do you want me to, or are you tired of my explanations?
No.
Is
there one underneath that one?
Pardon?
Yes, these two passionate authors. By the way, afterwards, feel free to... In fact, we'll break in about 5 minutes, probably, and then you just feel free to come and browse with me.
That's the one I've got.
You've got that one?
Yes, and I have all sorts of things to that, but I want to hear you.
No, first you tell me what it
is. See, I'm very strict about this.
Can you hold it?
I'm not allowed to have a drink. I have to hold it.
Yeah. And my coffee isn't brightly colored.
Yeah, they're hand-colored, and so they all vary slightly.
I sort of see it as, except the problem is the hand could be a woman's hand, but I sort of see the hand as a Christ-like hand. And there's some sense of being here in the... So I see it as kind of a sacramental kind of thing, with the flower being spring and hope, and the cloth in the background being another sort of sacramental, the sheet that covered the Savior's body, or a sacrament cloth over a sacrament table. And I have a sort of sense of reconciliation about it, because I see it as a hope coming out of, you know, difficult kinds of situations that we can't resolve, from a human standpoint.
Wonderful. I don't want to complain.
I will tell you a little bit about the history of the piece. It was actually done for the American Cancer Society. And so it has, so hence the geometry you see refers to technology, and their symbol of is the daffodil. So I'll just tell you that much. But it's actually, I mean, that's what I love, is that sense of liberty in interpretation. Oh, all right, well, let me quickly talk about a couple of these pieces. By the way, these boards here get you a feel of the layout of the book in color. Of course, the reproductions are dreadful, the quality of the reproduction, these are just mass. Oh, yes. Why don't we break it out and take it and just pass clumps of pages around so you can get a feel for it. Of course, it was supposed to be published, and Ron Pridis is back there laughing his head off, because it was supposed to be published April 18th. For the beginning of the exhibition. Then it was June 11th when I gave a lecture, and we still haven't got it, so anyway. Well, actually, we're working in a co-publishing situation, hopefully with Signature and then a little consortium of collectors. So we're still trying to work out the mechanics of that, because Signature originally were going to be sole publishers, but the book grew all out of proportion to reality, didn't it, Ron? So anyway, so afterwards, feel free to come. Let me quickly talk about a couple of these pieces, and then we'll summarize. This piece here, it's interesting to me. It was accidental that we got these pieces. Chronologically, that one and the big painting were done about the same time. And by the way, the big painting, the panels to the left and right are supposed to hang high so that the sharp red forms a square. So they hang normally at that level. That piece is entitled Prodigal. This is entitled Spirit Leaving. And the one on the easel here is entitled Shadow. We'll start with Shadow. And very quickly, I did a huge painting that's owned by Richard Worthland that is going to be donated to BYU and had two big plexiglass slabs in front of it. It was on the plan of salvation. When I came to you remember I had the man in thorns and the man in barbed wire? These figures represented that, and I call them shadow, because I think that is the part of life that is on the one hand the most difficult to deal with, but on the other hand it is also the part that gives depth and breadth and character to us. You know what also we should part that? In case any of you are ready, are interested in the book, there's an order form here that you can take home with you. And this is one of my very favorite pieces. That's all I really want to say about it from an interpretive point of view, but I believe it's this etching on the easel here. And it's one of my very favorite pieces of work I've ever done. I don't have one on my wall yet, but it's an etching, so I can. But I can't afford the frame, so. But that is one of my favorite pieces. Then the Spirit Leaving, I was fascinated with the, I'm fascinated with the whole notion of death. And I have a very interesting experience right now. Talk about reconciliation. My 81-year-old mother is living with me, and she's a wonderful old biddy. We've always been extremely close, and she's very naughty, but she is paying the price of 30 years of smoking 3 packs a day. She has emphysema. Last night, I flew in yesterday, and last night my son was on the phone to me twice where she was having severe attacks, where she was turning blue. And to witness this experience, and I'm horrified by the whole process of dying. I don't mind being dead one bit, but I hope to goodness the process isn't like that, you know. And my poor mother, they take her down to the hospital, they give her oxygen. She's this wonderful, perky lady. She entertains the whole, they don't want me to take her home because she's so funny. And then the next day, she's just a sad old thing, you know. It's a dreadful thing to watch. But this piece tackles the subject of death. And, of course, it's heroic. I don't do an old lady suffering from emphysema. I do a heroic young man who dies and his spirit soars away from his body with great strength. But it's wonderful to think that when my mother passes, which she will probably do pretty quickly, that her spirit at its most beautiful and powerful will soar away from her body. I don't believe that as an absolute belief. I just believe it as a wonderful possibility. But so, by the way, we were told we should hand these out to you when you walked in the door, and we thought it was way too crass and commercial. And in fact, even handing them to you now, I feel it's way too crass and commercial. But the whole point is that, you know, we have to be commercial, I suppose. Finally, I'll talk about Prodigal. And this painting's particularly interesting and extremely revealing. And if you want to get up and move around to look at it, feel free. BYU, I was teaching at BYU, and they commissioned me to do a painting for their collection. This is what I did in my naivete and stupidity. And they gave me a studio space for a summer, and I went in and I chose the topic of Prodigal. And the dean came and looked at the painting and walked up and down on it for 5 minutes, and he's so uncomfortable, and finally he said, you know, it's a magnificent painting, but there's no way we could ever hang it. And I thought, oh, surprise. I don't know what I'm thinking. The Catholics love me, by the way. I'm doing a big bronze for a Jesuit university in Pennsylvania, and they didn't ask for one little finger to be changed, so it's great. But I think I must have sensed that I was pushing the envelope, as they say, but I did the painting, and then he made a remark that made me very uncomfortable. He says, do you sometimes worry that your work reflects homosexuality? And of course, I thought I was so deep in the closet, nobody could possibly know this. I mean, what's so amazing is that literally I could do a painting like that and think that nobody would guess, just like Michelangelo. Of course, he's not homosexual, you know. So anyway, there's one little interesting thing to end with here, that before I go into the quick interpretation, we actually did exhibit it at BYU. And for the faculty show, I painted little, you see these geometric forms? If you notice on this man's bottom here, there's a little shade, a little whiteness just above his calf. I painted with gouache paint over the most offending parts, like bottoms, which is kind of a water-based paint, and I just blended it into the space. So he had a patch like a diaper on, and each of them had a diaper, I tried cloth at first, and it looked absurd. So then I decided this geometric thing, diaper, was better. Well, the students found out that it was gouache, and started coming up and licking their fingers and taking it off. So I was chewing my fingernails right the way through the exhibition, hoping that it would survive, you know. And then I kind of liked the aftermath, and that really reintroduced geometry into my work. But the piece is obvious if you look at the title, Prodigal. The prodigal son is reduced at the left. He's taking care of swine, and he's reduced to eating the husks of corn with the swine. Finally, he repents and humbles himself and goes back to his father, who receives him with great joy and exhilaration, and calls for the fatted calf to be killed and the best robe in the house to be brought to cover his nakedness. I'll tell you one little interesting side. Let me finish and then I'll tell you that. And then finally, he is reconciled not only to his father but to his heavenly father, because he's reached that sense of equilibrium and tranquility. I don't deal with issues like the other son, with whom I sympathize deeply, by the way. Of course, there's another whole interpretation to this painting that I chose not to see. But the man who's exiled from his society because he doesn't fit the paradigm, because he's not a rugger player, is reduced to being isolated, and he is allowed only the husks of comfort and intimacy. He can't have intimacy because it's taboo. Finally, however, he violates the taboo, and he walks into an environment where he is brought into the embrace of a person who loves him completely and intimately, and thus he's reconciled to himself and his heavenly father because he is integrated. He has come to terms with whom he is. So that's another interpretation. Yes?
Well, do you have any, now that we're talking a little bit about the nakedness issue here, do you have any comments about the Genesis story and God covered their nakedness? I mean, what is your sense of that?
Well, you know, my sense is, that's the way it is. I mean, but that was the evil man. That was the man, the sinner, that was covered. The man that I paint is not the sinner. The man that I paint is the baby that's born into the world. That's one of the reasons I think I use idealized figures. These are not real people. These are heroic figures. And, of course, there's a huge tradition with Michelangelo and Leonardo and the Renaissance. So that's my tradition before I came upon Mormonism and had to deal with the Genesis story. We have 5-10 minutes left, Guy? Yeah. Yes. David Smith Harrison.
Therefore, is there going to be a school of Trevor Southey?
David was my apprentice for six years, and we're very close friends. In fact, he was one of the people that I had unrequited love thing going on with. And David is actually mentioned very briefly in the book, but he is a great friend of mine, and yeah, this is possible, but I don't know, who knows, you know. I get cross with him because he does it better in some ways. Yes. Oh, there's not much of an... Well, there is a little bit. I don't paint flowers because it's commercially a smart thing to do. I paint flowers because I love them, because they bring me close to my core and my center. And to me, you know, I was going to mention the danger of pretty and too much passion, sentimentality, and things like that. So I'll come back to the book in a second. If you look on the man's shoulder in the center, the prodigal shoulder, you'll see some lines. Susanna, can you see them there? Can you point them out? Those were actually the hands of the father. At one point, I had his hand literally embracing the son. It was too hot. It was too claustrophobic. It was too emotional and too sentimental. So I dropped it by the side. So he's bringing it up to that point. And that's where, you know, those are the kinds of things that one has to be very careful with. The cover of the book is part of a painting that if you look on, in fact, that page right there, can you lift that page right there, Sai, and pass that back to, there's the full painting there. What they did is the designers did this. I would never have had the thought to do this. They just lifted this fragment out, and it's a wonderfully mysterious fragment to me, and it drops us into the book and surprises us when we get inside. So I was very happy with it. Mitch had written, I'd met him before, and actually in the end he selected me, because this book was muddling along and putzing along, and I wasn't, and he said, I'm flying out, and I'm going to interview, and I'm going to write this for you. And so that's kind of how it happened. So he had known my work. I'd exhibited in D.C. substantially and known my work for a long time, and so that's how it happened. And, you know, he's writing to Ron and Gary a signature and for their approval, and so they felt good about it, and so we went from there. Yes, and then...
Well, I was just very moved by this painting, and I would just like to say what I felt about it.
Oh, that's...
I looked at it, and I felt like, that's the priesthood. That is the reconciliation of the female and the male side coming together into one male wholeness, or whatever. And that was very powerful.
That's terrific. You know, I have to tell you, I was very uncomfortable bringing this painting in, because it's the most... sensual, perhaps one of the most sensual paintings I've ever done, and I never set out to shock people or be, you know, confrontive. That just happens to be where I am. I'm actually a person who's wanted all his life to live in Alpine, Utah, with my wife and children and rocking chairs and all that stuff. I didn't want to be this weird person, but just who I am, I guess. Yes.
Return to the Rose Lillegrad.
Yes.
You have a lot of lines that are straight lines. Uh-huh.
They were. I cannot draw a straight line.
What do such things mean?
The geometry in my work has come to be extremely important. It's like the vocabulary is not complete until it's there. Sometimes I don't use it because, you know, if it calls for me, then I use it. There are two primary reasons for it. One, I believe, is if you imagine a potato as an organic form that's rather nondescript, and then you take a knife and slice it, all of a sudden takes on a totally new dimension. The same thing is exactly what happens at the painting. Because my painting is so loaded with romance and sensuality, even the pigment itself, the color, I find the geometry is like the impact of a knife on a potato. It just gives that bite. I also think it suggests to me, one of the things you've probably understood from our discussion today, is I'm a person who craves a sense that there's a cosmic order. I can't bear the thought of the San Francisco earthquake. I still suffer from that. To this day, there are times when I will wake up with my heart just beating because, and I'm not afraid of dying, not in the least, but I am afraid of, you know, of war. I mean, I hate Hitler because of this huge, you know, upheaval I dream of the human species growing as I think we were intended to do. I know it'll never happen. I'm finally coming to terms with evil. So those lines then are in effect an appeal for a cosmic order. Anything else?
What about the fish I'm seeing and the red panel
that looks like? That's not a fish. I never thought of a fish. That's a wonderful view you've seen. Yeah, it could be the Christian fish. It's actually, I hate to tell you this, but no, I won't tell you because it's just too mundane. It's so mundane. I loved that. It was a sleeping bag that was my model. And so there was the quilting in the sleeping bag. Isn't that awful? But, you know, that's the real world. That's the way it is. Yeah.
It looks like it's soft and velvety and there's silk.
Yeah, it was silk. I think it was. But it was nice. Any other comments, observations, or rude remarks? My daughter.
Painting reconciliation. I've seen that a number of times, and something I never thought about is the significance of the pearl.
Oh, I didn't talk about the pearl, did I?
No, but I thought about how all the different things represent different conflicts, different difficult experiences you go through life, but then it's all kind of summarized in the pearl that after all the pressure, after all the difficulty, beauty comes to it in reconciliation.
That's the pearl. I didn't go to the pearl. Yeah, pearl of great price. Beauty by sacrifice. And ultimately, that is the greatest beauty. That's what in relationships is the greatest beauty.
Do you exhibit anything at your studio in San Francisco?
I do. So anytime if you come to San Francisco, I'll meet you by appointment. I don't exhibit much. It's very much a roll of the dice. If something exciting is happening, it's there. Right now, I do not have a single painting. I have a few drawings, but almost nothing in my studio. There's a huge shortage of unique work, and it's exciting and terrifying at the same time. Okay, if that's it, I thank you very, very much. It's wonderful.